faith educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by one of the founders of our center and one of the most important people within the NYU ecosystem, Dr. Linda Mills. She created the Of Many film, which you've heard referenced many times on this podcast, and has been instrumental in setting up NYU's global sites and how NYU approaches religious and spiritual life in countries all around the world. She has a great perspective on these topics, and we look forward to you being able to hear this conversation and learn from her incredible wisdom. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful and out of this week's conversation. I am joined today by Linda Mills, the Vice Chancellor for Global Programs and University Life at NYU, and one of the founders and one of the co-chairs of the advisory board of the Of Many Institute. Linda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you have been involved with our center and religious life at NYU for a while now, and you probably have more institutional knowledge than anyone else as to how our center came to be and why NYU cares so much about religious life. And then you also have the added bonus and perspective because you've helped set up global sites in Abu Dhabi and Shanghai and have been overseeing global sites across Europe, South America, Australia. So I'm curious, over the last couple of years that you've been doing this, what have been some of the areas that have been the hard areas, the particularly challenging areas in working with religious life on what is one of the few universities in the world that's truly global?
So I think for me, the issues that are the most difficult and compelling happen when there's a kind of clash of interests. And in a sense, the overriding interest is creating an environment where you can have a conversation about that clash, but also in such a way that people don't feel silenced, marginalized, not heard around a particular issue. So it's a really complicated path to kind of to navigate when a certain interest group will want a certain speaker that feels to another interest group like that person obliterates their very being. Right. And as much as we don't live in a world of war, thankfully, I mean, we do, there's plenty of wars going on in the world, but right here in New York City, which is one of many frames of reference that I'll use, but that it's complicated, it's still complicated, and people see it as quite life-threatening. Mm-hmm. They even see somebody coming to speak about a particular issue as life-threatening.
Yeah.
And that always surprises me because I have a very high tolerance mm-hmm. for creating an environment where people can at least hear what people have to say, even if they right. don't agree with it.
Do you think that the tolerance for views that are different than ours have changed?
Oh, completely.
You think we have less of an ability to hear or listen?
Yes, absolutely. I think that over time, people, as we have become much more aware of trauma and the impact of issues on people's emotional well-being, that people feel as though they're nervous to even hear. Because to hear is somehow to impact, and to impact is somehow to be emotionally hurt by it. And I just think we're more resilient than that. At least I was raised in an environment in which resilience was really important. And the way you built your resilience was actually by listening to hard things. So I think listening is really a skill we need to develop. I understand why people feel as though the very act of listening mm-hmm. is somehow legitimizing. And at the same time, I believe that a kind of openness and possibility of crossing those bridges and listening is key to human collaboration, cooperation, and the future of even the race.
Right. So you were mentioning that you were kind of raised to listen and to be resilient. And I personally know elements of your story and have come through films and just conversations that we've had. But maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit how your own approach to this has been formed by different aspects of your life that are really quite interesting.
Yeah. So I think that story, even though it starts much earlier in my childhood, really starts on September 11th. We lived live and lived three blocks from the World Trade Center, and our son was 5 years old on the day and in his third day of kindergarten. So it was his first long day. I don't know how many people remember kindergarten, but there were the short days, and then all of a sudden for a five-year-old, you were going to go until 3 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness.
That was like big, right? I mean, you know, 9 to 11 or 9 to 12 was one thing, but right. until 3, it was a big deal. And so we had been preparing our son, Ronnie, for that day. And I remember, of course, it was an election day, and Mark Green was actually handing out flyers at the front of the school at the time. So Ronnie was at PS 234, which is the elementary school closest to the World Trade Center. It's about three blocks away, as is our apartment. And we had just said goodbye to Ronnie, and a few kids were still trailing into the school following the teacher. And all of a sudden, a plane came overhead, and it sounded, first of all, right above our heads, almost mm-hmm. like you could raise your hand and touch right. it. That's how close it was. And also that the person who was flying the plane was braking. It felt like they were putting the brakes on the plane. And this is something that, unless you were there in the moment,
right.
you didn't know. It looked like it was lining up. Mm-hmm. to be right in front of the building. And in fact, that's what it was. And then after braking, you heard accelerating. And the plane literally accelerated and went into the building. Now, I was listening to these sounds, but I'm also somebody who's done trauma work for a very long time. And I thought to myself, you're not looking. You are not looking. You are not looking, because this does not sound good. Mm-hmm. And I look over at my husband and I see him, who's very tall, looking at the building and looking at the plane. And I thought, that's not good. So you're not looking. So anyways, the plane goes into the building, and I knew it was terrorism. I don't know why. Terrorism was not even defined as a term. Before mm-hmm. 9/11, really. But anyways, I knew it was terrorism, and the first thing I knew was that we had to go find Ronnie. So we mm-hmm. go into the school, and we go up to his room, and the room is a picture window view of the World Trade Center, and you can see the burning,
right.
the plane in it, the flames coming out. It was a very shocking and unsettling view. Of course, my husband had seen it earlier. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I saw it. And I just kept saying, where's Ronnie? Where's Ronnie? And it took a really long time for Ronnie to come upstairs, because his teacher, brilliantly, thought something's wrong and I don't want our kids to see that through the window, the picture window. And so she kept them downstairs. Ronnie then came up and I said, Ronnie! I saw him walk through the doorway and I said, Ronnie, are you okay? I should have been so much more calm. But anyway, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, Mom, what's your problem? I mean, it wasn't quite that, because he was 5. It's more like a 13-year-old. At any rate, so he said, yeah, Mom, I'm fine, I'm fine. And everybody was sort of very unsettled, and nobody understood exactly what it was. And an announcement by the principal over the loudspeaker said, everybody should just sit down, and we're going to take story time. We're going to mm-hmm. do story time. And they started to read books, and I looked at Peter, and I said, there is a burning building that can fall completely onto right. this school right this minute. I grew up in California where there were earthquakes, and I just said, we need to get out of here. So we took Ronnie, and we walked downstairs. Everybody else was still in the building, and we walked downstairs, and we took his best friend, and we took his best friend's mother. We walked on the street. And his best friend's mother turned to me and said, I'm thinking I'm going to go to work. And I said, fine, we're more than happy mm-hmm. to take Yoji. But the bottom line here is this day is going to go down in American history.
Right.
And just as I said that, the second plane came through the World Trade Center over our head. We picked up Ronnie, she picked up Yoji, and we went running for our lives. Mm-hmm. And there's various photos of that. So anyways, we came up here. We were trying to decide where to go. We couldn't go to our apartment because our apartment was so close to what had happened. We came up here. We decided to go to NYU rather than Cardozo, because Cardozo was a Jewish school, and we right. were worried about the meaning of all this. By this time, my husband works at Cardozo. And slowly but surely, it started to come out that they thought it was terrorism, and it looked planned at mm-hmm. this point when you have two planes.
Yeah.
So at any rate, that event happens. We're out of our house for 6 weeks. A plane part tears through the roof of our building, and we have about $100,000 mm-hmm. damage because there was rain those few days afterwards. At any rate, that obviously becomes a formative event in our lives, right. and we are, living day to day. It's not clear where we're going to live. Will we ever be able to go back to mm-hmm. our apartment? We live in the red zone. They have it closed off. The city's completely closed off. And during that time, our son started to ask questions like, why did they want to kill us?
Right.
And that's what generated the set of larger contemplations that I went through in terms of my mother's history as a Holocaust survivor. And I started to ask questions about how would my mother answer the question, why did they want to kill us? And I didn't think that she'd answer it in a way that I wanted to answer it with my son.
Right.
And as much as the terrorists claimed that they were Muslim, from my point of view, I knew that Islam didn't represent hate and killing. And, you know, I had enough of a sense of mm-hmm. that. I didn't know a lot about the religion, but I had enough of a sense of that. And so I needed to go on a journey to ask the question, how do I answer my son's pressing question, why do they hate us? And so the first question was, who hates us? And then the second question was, why do they hate us? And I think that I was clear that I needed to be able to teach my son a kind of ambiguity, complexity around how people join, you know, in ways that are not productive in the world, that are hateful. And that just because they claim it's in the name of a religion doesn't mean that it's in the name of a religion. In the case of Nazis, it just doesn't mean that it was in the name of all Germans.
Right.
And so you had to ask a deeper set of questions. And I was prepared to ask those questions in part because of my own work in domestic violence. I always knew that we were always too narrow.
Mm-hmm.
So to get back to your original question, that was a very long way of getting to the answer, which is complexity and listening and looking at a problem in greater depth allows for a much more nuanced answer.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was life and death for our family.
Right. And so I want to bring a few of those threads together, because you mentioned you've done a lot of work in domestic violence. And it's actually how my boss, Yael, originally got involved in a lot of these things, was through your domestic violence work. You're also a filmmaker. You work for NYU in kind of this global setting, and you've managed to weave all of these together through the work that you're doing and setting up sites globally, but also just working with issues that arise with religion on a global scale. And so I think if we kind of looked at it from the outside looking in, it would seem that all of those you kind of start talking about how all these came together, but this is it's a diverse set of skills and interests that have come together in the last few years, and that you've done a movie with, you started a center, all of these things are kind of coming together, which I'm fortunate for, because that gave me a job. But it's a really interesting mix that I think is pretty unique for, at least for universities, it is.
So it's interesting. I never would have thought that my domestic violence work had so much resonance for the way in which I look at issues that might bubble up, for example, in a global setting. So my domestic violence work, now longstanding, 20 years, really has focused on the complexity of how domestic violence happens, how somebody becomes or transitions into becoming violent. Usually that means they were a victim in their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then what that means in terms of, if you have both victimhood and perpetration in one life experience, how do you actually deal with that complexity? You have to get to the victimization in order to help inform
mm-hmm.
how the perpetration happened. And if you don't see that as a kind of a complex problem, but simply only look at perpetration, or for that matter, only look at victimization, you'll never be able to address it. So I think, insofar as our global work is so complicated, insofar as thinking across religious boundaries is so complicated, I think my domestic violence, the work I did in untangling the meaning and insights into domestic violence, really became the precursor for a much more complicated and nuanced analysis of what do you do when a problem comes up in a global site and there is a clash, let's mm-hmm. say, of two communities. It also shows up in, of course, my film work, because I became really interested, and I was just in Tunisia a month ago showing the Of Many film, which is the film about Khaled and Yehuda, and all of a sudden I could see that the ways in which film served this larger mm-hmm. purpose is it became a 34, in this case, a 33-minute focal point for people to watch and then ask questions about and have a dialogue about.
Right.
What seemed obvious is, again, about complexity. In other words, people in Tunisia, Muslims for the most part, is who came to see the film, in Tunisia said, well, you know, you're American, and Americans hate us. And they said that because of what they see in the mm-hmm. news now in elections. Americans hate us. Why did you come to this work in this more nuanced way? And right. what did that mean? All of a sudden, the filmmaking became just another way of having a complicated conversation about a topic like religion and clash.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've just had the most privileged academic life that allows me to not only figure out how to solve, let's say, student conflict in a global site, that's not the only kinds of conflicts we have, but of one, how to then open up a much larger conversation in two cities, which right. I had the privilege of visiting for Tunisia, but also just the way in which my academic work had informed that opening.
So you started touching on how this type of work has an inevitable intersection with politics and the political climate. And I know just kind of our team and the people involved were always talking about internally how whatever's going on in the United States or broader geopolitics, how that's going to influence the lives of our students. I know it's something that the university thinks a lot about. In the last, I think, 2 years, we've seen a few really, really big incidents that have happened that have involved religion and the public square in some sort or another. We had the attacks in Paris last year, and NYU, we have a site there. The current political rhetoric in this election in the United States has been troubling, to say the least, especially as it relates to our Muslim students. I know that they're really feeling the brunt of a lot of that. And so I'm curious because we work for NYU and because we come to it we have access to so many extra resources, like what is the role that this type of stuff has? Like how can we, what is the kind of imprint yeah. that we can be making that's better?
So let's start with the kind of political environment. And I was, you know, deeply struck and continue to be deeply struck by the stories of our Muslim students and their experience, even here in New York City, mm-hmm. let alone around the world, and how painful it is because there is nothing we can do to guard against it except to say that we're a welcoming, accepting, and right. loving community that can help teach our community to be more embracing, more mm-hmm. understanding, more smart about
right.
learning the differences between somebody who claims they're a terrorist in the name of Islam and what Islam represents. So I do think that we have a deep responsibility to our community and can play a formative role in advancing this conversation in a very different way and counteracting the kinds of conversations that are happening, in a sense, in the public square. In terms of Paris and and terrorism, I think that our reaction was twofold, multifold, and Yehuda and I did some of this work together. The first one, of course, was in the most recent terrorist attacks in Paris. It was absolutely terrifying because they were very, very close to our residence hall, one of our residence halls. And so our first effort has to be that we're sure that our students are okay.
I imagine right? safety is the
yeah,
number one.
Absolutely. I need to make sure that, and this is my responsibility together with other people with whom I work very closely, including Josh Taylor, Nancy Morrison, is to make sure that our students are safe and then to help families feel as though mm-hmm. it's okay. You know, initially a number of families, like we felt after 9/11, wanted mm-hmm. to bring their students home. Once we knew everybody was fine, and that was completely understandable. What we know about trauma is that oftentimes if you can stand it and live through it and get back to your routine, it actually helps you psychologically mm-hmm. work through the trauma in a very different kind of way. And I learned that at very close range with Ronnie, our son, mm-hmm. at post 9/11. So it's the struggle to try and educate students and their families that actually the best thing for students is to be able to figure out how to make this work with our support, right. with our clarity that we are there as a safety net. But sometimes people can't tolerate it. It's just mm-hmm. too much, and that's completely understandable, and they need to leave. And so a lot of the work was just helping students work their way through those decisions. But there's a second and then a third dimension. The second dimension is within our own community. So it just so happened that Yehuda and I were there after one of the Paris attacks, in particular the one on the kosher market. Mm-hmm. And Yehuda and I were able to show of many to the NYU Paris mm-hmm. community. And it was a moment for everybody to come together. And there were Muslim students there who were really scared about being in Paris after that.
Yeah.
And it was a great moment for both affirming their sense of membership in the community because of Khaled's role, important role in the film, mm-hmm. but also the complete embrace the film suggests. And then for the community to be able to come together and ask a set of questions that in France, right. they don't
very
ask.
Difficult to
very
ask
different kinds of questions. I mean, in France, the question is whether somebody can cover.
Right.
You know, I mean, that goes without saying in our culture.
Right. And if you look at our office in the Center for Spiritual Life, it's like there are any given time 30-40% of the people in the room could be wearing hijab.
Yeah.
And that would just be, that's such a different dynamic.
Yes, exactly. And so some of this was opening up that, whoa, America really does this differently, or at least New York City,
right.
let's say, really does this differently. And so opened our NYU and Paris community up in a different kind of way. That was really moving to watch mm-hmm. and observe. And then finally, Yehuda and I had the privilege of going to, painfully, the school that was closest to the kosher market mm. and visiting with parents and the school administrators about their fears that they were sending their children to school, to a school that was so close to what this event that had happened. It seemed so obvious that Yehuda and I, as NYU representatives, but also as members of the New York City community, had so much to offer in terms of our own experience of what happened post 9/11 and mm-hmm. to help these families feel as though you're in a moment of crisis, completely understandable, but it will calm down.
Right.
It will resolve. It doesn't feel like that right now, especially when you had something like 8 men
right.
with machine guns inside the school. Terrifying. Seemed much more dangerous than not having 8 men with
right.
machine guns, but be that as it may. The point is that we have a community responsibility that's outside of NYU. We have an NYU responsibility. And it seems that, and we have a responsibility to our community in terms mm-hmm. of number one safety.
Yeah, I think, so recently there was a little thing that happened that I saw Khaled posted about it. And I met the student when he was coming into our office, but a Latino student was walking on the street here.
Here in New York City,
and someone mistook him for someone who's Muslim, and then started yelling something Islamophobic at him, which was not only wrong because he wasn't Muslim, it was also just blatantly wrong. And then the student just had this incredible reaction where he realized that it didn't really bother him all that much because he wasn't Muslim, so he kind of was able to shake it off. But then he thought, this must be happening to all the Muslim students on campus all the time. And he went and bought a bouquet of flowers to deliver to the Islamic Center and brought them in and gave it to Amira, mm-hmm. the program coordinator there in Khaled, just to say, like, mm-hmm. sorry that this kind of stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And so we can do those types of things and those
little acts of kindness
and those gestures. But I often talk to students about it. And, like, there's very little I can do sitting from my office I can't have that much of an influence beyond the people I work with, the community mm-hmm. I interact mm-hmm. with, right? Mm-hmm. The New York City mm-hmm. is many people, the world is really mm-hmm. big. So what are the types of things that we can or should be doing more of? Yeah. And the reason I'm asking you actually is because I am not someone who's particularly artistic and would never think of film as one of those ways, but I've yeah. seen how the film yeah. does amazing work in this regard and how it opens a conversation and allows people to think about questions they maybe wouldn't want to confront otherwise. So what are some other tools or yeah. good ways that we have in our toolbox that you've seen work well?
So what I'd say is the first and foremost is for people to feel as though they have a community of support. And I think that is, and particularly for our Muslim students who feel under attack, that they feel as though they have a community of support here at NYU that they can go to in time of need. I think that's really important. I mean, a lot of Muslims around the United States have none of that.
None of it.
You know, they might have a family member, they might have a mosque that they go to, but not in the extensive way in which we create a safety net, emotional bridge, all of the things that we can do. And I think each and every one of us has a responsibility to reach out mm-hmm. and to do a little act of kindness, because when it does happen, when that kind of experience happens, the person is more resilient. There is a way in which they feel as though they're part of something, and that stupidity that comes out in a racist way, whether it's stupid, whether it's venomous, whatever it is, that it's clear that they can be sort of shoved aside, I wouldn't say physically to do so, but, you know, pushed aside so that people know that they have the support they need. I certainly know this as a Jewish woman. I rarely experience some version of discrimination based on my race, because I don't mm-hmm. have to identify. My name is Mills. Nobody would know that. But the point is that when it does happen, I know how important it is that I have a community of support. I think, so that's number one. The second is community building, where when a new event happens and students feel as though, or we are likely to be able to measure when there are increases mm-hmm. in racist activities, that we can provide ourselves as support for people who are walking somewhere, who are driving some, whatever it is that they need, mm-hmm. but that we can be a team of people who can be supportive of them so that they know they can get from point A to point B in a safe way. I think the third one really is film, and I am so struck now, having shown the film to thousands of people, that film can be a deep bridge. It is a profound.
It works.
It really works.
I was just at a conference. I was presenting at a conference in Columbus, Georgia last week, and they wanted a talk about religious literacy building, and then also wanted to like do a little film screening as one of their breakout mm-hmm. sessions. And the film never ceases. It wins every time. Everyone loves it.
Keeps on giving.
It does.
And, you know, having been in Tunisia and shown it to about 500 both filmmakers, students, and young people. And Tunisia's just been through this horrible period of terrorism, that it is so interesting because the film is so positive and people say, it's so sappy, it's so ridiculous. And then I say to them, but do you get any dose of we can make this work anywhere in your life? And the answer is no. Everywhere right. It's conflict, never. The Middle East, there are a million reasons why we should hate each other. And, you know, we've given them 33 minutes of people kind of loving each other, and that's okay. That's a good thing. And so it does. It just keeps on giving. I think the other, so anytime that you have an idea for a film, I'm game. So I'm definitely game. I think the other thing that was and has been for me the greatest and most important learning experience really focuses on educating myself about Islam. And I cannot believe how naive Americans mm-hmm. are in knowing anything about a religion, and then just, you know, they know nothing about the religion, and then they jump to a trillion mm-hmm. conclusions. There are lots of reasons why there's so much misinformation, whether it's a political candidate or whether it's the news. But I do think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves about religions so that we can. I mean, when we interviewed Khalid for the film, the thing that I was probably most struck by as a kind of spiritual person, as much as I'm Jewish, I'm not religiously Jewish, was how compatible the two religions are, how loving the two religions are, which is, of course, the point in the movie, but how similar the two religions are and how religion really is, in the name, for the most part, in the name of good. And yet it becomes the place of war. I mean, it's so paradoxical. All I can say is, particularly Americans, having been and spent so much time in the Muslim world, whether it's in Abu Dhabi and now more recently in Tunisia, we need to educate ourselves about Islam in order to be smart about being able to articulate the difference between what's happening in terrorism and what's happening in the religion.
Right. And one of the reasons that a university is one of the best places to do some of this stuff is because studies consistently show that your most diverse group of friends that you'll develop at any point in your life generally happens at a university, because it's just, you're not segmented by interest group as much or by race, or, I mean, there are issues with that stuff, but in general, you're going to have your most diverse group of friends. And there also is a lot of studies out there that tell us that one friend from an identity that you don't share makes you 40% less likely to harbor negative views of that group. So if that can, you know, the university, I think part of the project of the university is to try and replicate that as much as possible.
I couldn't agree more, and that's why we made a movie about two people who are, you know, an unlikely friendship.
An unlikely friendship. Well, thank you, Linda. This has been so much fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
So fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. I'd especially like to thank our guests, Dr. Linda Mills, for being just incredibly generous with her time to our center always, and for joining us on the podcast. It's so much fun to get to spend time with her, podcast or not. Special thank you to Liz Butters, whose music is from the Many Film, which you heard referenced a lot in this podcast. And of course, thank you as always to Brian Young, our editor and producer, all the way from Ghana. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu, and please rate and review us on iTunes. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the program. Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We look forward to having you back next week.